Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Dungeons & Dragons hits theaters, so we're going to give you a review. And Zach Braff has a new film called A Good Person, so he stops by the show for a conversation. Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 255 of Real Blend, a podcast that still has a perfect bracket. Go Florida Atlantic, baby! I got them going all the way. I can't wait to see how much money I'm going to win from this week's Final Four. On this week, Kevin, that's a sports joke. I just want to let you know.
Yeah,
Kevin's sports knowledge, I'd like to say, has increased dramatically. I feel like you've gotten so much more into football over the last 12 months.
I have. I just don't know what Florida Atlantic is. What's that mean?
It's a team in the Final Four.
They're called it Florida Atlantic.
Yes, they are. They're one of the teams, one of the schools that are still left in the competition.
It's a school, which is a little
strange name.
I'd love an NFL team named Florida Atlantic.
Kev, knowing how much you love championship games, you have to watch the Final Four games and the championship.
Dude, the year I graduated from George Mason was the year we went to the Final Four. It was 2006. And my school, prior to that, I felt like people looked at it more of like a commuter school. And when we got on the map with that story, that we were the Cinderella story. Jim Larinaga. Yeah, Jim Larinaga was our coach. And I will never forget what that felt like to be at that school at that time. I went to Indianapolis. We got beat by Florida. I think it was the gentleman with the long hair.
Atlantic.
Yeah. No, but I remember his name. There was a guy on that team who I think he went on to the NBA. We lost in that first game in the Final Four.
It was Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan. Yeah. This is the story of Air. This is what Air is about.
He has a shoe now.
Yeah. That did forever changed our school. It was so cool, man. Like just people walking around with our Final Four shirts on. I still have some of them. The team was signing them. It was just cool. Like see the players walking through and getting autographs and photos. And it was a big deal. So I know what it means for a school to go through something like that, especially if you're a school that's not really on the map in terms of like Mason was on the map, but they weren't like super, super well known outside of being a commuter school in Fairfax. But now they are. So.
By the way, we were brought to you by Barstool Sports this week. We're changing up format. No. On this week's show, Dungeons & Dragons is going to be hitting theaters and is a surprise favorite of the year, as you guys will hear when we review it later on. And then Zach Braff has a movie coming to theaters called A Good Person. It expands wide, and the filmmaker is going to join us to discuss. I'm telling you guys right now, it is a fantastic, fantastic conversation with Braff. We will throw it to that in a heartbeat. Before that, let me get to proud George Mason graduate Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kev. How are you?
Hello, Jonathan, Gabriel, Jacob. How are you guys?
And Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
University of Houston graduate. And so you can understand why my bracket is not looking as good. Right.
Your guys
now.
Went far, though. I give them credit.
Not far enough for number one seed.
No number one seed did well this year.
I know.
That was remarkable. Well, the Catholic University of America is Division III, and we don't compete in much of anything. That's my alma mater, by the way. And so,
are you on their like wall of fame?
I don't think so. No, I don't think we have. Ed McMahon is our most famous.
But you seem like the next logical step.
And Susan Sarandon. No, Susan Sarandon also graduated from our drama program.
We have Randy Quaid.
I think I win that one.
We all have Randy Quaid. So.
Are you talking about people who are famous from your school?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that
they have Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure one of the authors who wrote American Prometheus, which is what Nolan based Oppenheimer on.
About Oppenheimer.
No, but I'm pretty sure it was either Kai Bird or Martin Sherwin. I think I have their names right, but one of them is a George Mason professor or has some connection to George Mason. So I'm going to go ahead and just claim that because it's an Oppenheimer connection.
We're going to start a drinking game for any time anyone mentions Oppenheimer on this show.
Through July. Friend of the show and a friend of mine has a personal drinking game, and he takes a shot every time we mention that we used to be an awards podcast.
Oh, that's a good one.
He drinks a lot.
For anybody who doesn't know, we started as Awards Blend.
Yeah. Do you guys remember when we did that? We were an awards show for 8 weeks. You guys remember that?
I remember that. Yes. It was called Awards Blend.
Yeah. I really like the name Awards Blend.
And he's drunk.
If you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Thank you for joining us. Please don't drink this early in the morning on Friday, notification crew. We don't want to have you start your day off on the wrong foot. Please head down.
Maybe
give us
they're
a
on
like.
The other side of the globe.
Yeah,
that's a good point. And there is also a West Coast contingent that weighs in every once in a while.
Also, I've got a 9 a.m. Flight on Friday. So don't tell me what to do.
Genuine question. When someone says it's 5 o'clock somewhere, is it actually always 5 o'clock somewhere?
No, it's only okay. if you're the place that you're at is at the like 00 mark of the hour.
I mean, I'm talking about in the world, if someone says that, is it 5 o'clock somewhere?
I know what you're saying, yes. Yeah. Like if it's 10 a.m. for us, it has to be 5 p.m. somewhere in the world.
But if it's 10:30 a.m. for us, it's not 5 o'clock anywhere.
But it's after 5 o'clock. I think the
listen,
idea is that
listen,
it's after
you don't
o'clock.
Get to speak on his lyrics, okay?
Wait, whose lyrics are those?
Is that Jimmy Buffett?
It's Buffett.
Oh, I thought like that was just Buffett. A saying. I didn't know it was
Buffett
song.
I believe originally it was a Shakespeare quote.
You guys want to start the show?
Jesus. Sure.
If you're watching us on YouTube, give us a like and a subscribe. I don't know why you would, but please give us a like and a subscribe. YouTube.com/RealBlendPodcast. So we have a giveaway this week, and I want to plug that. Cinema Blend is giving away codes for digital copies of James Cameron's Avatar: The Way of Water.
Ooh, I want one.
Yeah. Check the description for links on how you can enter. You must be 13 years of age or older and in the U.S. I'm sorry about that, but you have to be in the U.S. We want to thank our friends at Movies Anywhere for providing us the codes to Avatar: The Way of Water. Again, check the links in the description for how to enter on Facebook and Twitter. So as mentioned, Zach Braff directed Garden State. Helmed a couple other films in between there that, in my opinion, didn't quite reach the level of Garden State, but it's coming back with a really strong film called A Good Person. That is
A Good Person.
A Good Person. What did I say? The A Good Person.
Yep.
Stars Florence Pugh. He wrote it specifically for Florence Pugh while the two of them were in COVID lockdown. Essentially, he talks about it in the interview how he needed a distraction and started to write about things that he knew about his hometown and the people who grew up there and some of the things that he was dealing with emotionally. Tremendous performance by Florence, tremendous performance by Morgan Freeman as well too, and just some excellent direction and screenwriting by Zach. So we're going to put this one on your guys' radar, starting with this Real Blend interview between the guys and Zach Braff.
Yeah, can you hear? We've been having a lot of discussions about dating, so hopefully you guys weren't listening or like.
Oh, we heard it all. They're setting up the light, and I'm like, are these guys in a joint therapy session?
We're like best. We're best friends.
That's what our podcast is.
Yeah, I get it. I do one with my best friend. Yeah. I love it.
Well, I'll go ahead and start us off. I guess we're rolling, good to go. Well, first of all, I'll just introduce us to who our show is. We're called Real Blend. We're a filmmaker podcast. We're a filmmaker-focused podcast. And the whole idea of our show is trying to get our listeners engaged in the filmmaking process. So we're going to get super technical with you as well. We're best friends who met on the junkets, Jake and Sean and myself. We walked out of a Gravity screening one night and we were so blown away that we got together and started talking about movies, and now our show exists, and now Zach Braff, you're joining
that's
us.
That's so cool. I love it. I'm going to start listening to your podcast. It sounds right up
my
alley.
Hell yes. We're going to dive in because I have a lot of questions about your lens choices and all those things. I'm going to get into that in a bit. But first of all, I want to go back to early on. Garden State was a film that I saw in theaters. I'll never forget seeing it. The soundtrack, as Jake and I were talking earlier, is iconic, and it's just a great film. But that was a really early film. I think it was your first feature as a director. And as we sit here now, all these years later, your storytelling is incredible. And I'm wondering, when you look back at that particular project and that film, was there a lesson or two that you learned on it that you still apply now on A Good Person? Is there things that you look back on and go, oh, I learned that, I learned this, and then now you're directing your actors and thinking about those scenes and those moments?
You know, I think, I don't know if it was Tarantino who said it or some great filmmaker said, like, make the movie that you want to see. Mm. And I think that that's how I think that's something that happened with Garden State. I certainly didn't think anyone was going to see Garden State. I thought, you know, I would go to Sundance and my parents would see it and maybe a handful of people. I didn't think that it would become what it became. I was 25 years old when I wrote it. But I was most definitely writing the movie that I wanted to see. I wrote something that was about the experiences I was having as a young man, the isolation, the depression I was feeling, the lostness, the prayer that some amazing woman would come along and save me from myself. Mm. All of that was what I was feeling. And so similarly now, this many years later, I definitely felt like I wanted to write something. If I was going to write something that was authentically me, I wanted to write about what I was experiencing. And I had experienced a lot of grief in the last 4 years. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to set it in my hometown again, because there was a certain comfort. It's almost like a security blanket, if you will, of going, I know that I can be authentic about my hometown. I know that I won't mess that up. I know what the dive bar looks like. I know what a rundown house looks like. I know what that is. The duck pond I used to go to as a child. That's literally my high school principal's office where Morgan goes. Cool. I knew that, like, I wanted to make something so real and authentic and true. So there's almost a security blanket aspect of like setting it in my hometown. And so that's what I guess I started off with and have come back to is writing about exactly what I'm feeling and hoping that other people can relate and setting it in my hometown, just so I feel like I'm going to nail the authenticity of these people.
Mm. Wow.
Zach, your writing on this is incredible.
Thank you, man.
It's really, really emotional and honest and doesn't pull any punches, really. As we're getting through it, I realized what a different movie you made because you jumped forward a year as to where these characters
were. Absolutely. That's well said. Yeah.
And if you had done it like immediately after the accident, we'd be watching a completely different movie.
I didn't want to make that movie. That's a very good point. And no one's brought that up so far. But the truth is, I didn't want to make that film.
I win.
No, I love it. So, you know, you're doing a junk in it and someone asks a question you've never been asked. You're like, yeah, nice one.
We love that.
No, but the truth is, I didn't want to make that story. I wasn't really interested in exploring the trauma of physical rehab or the morning after. Mm. So I treat it just as a screenwriter. I treat that whole section as a bit of a prologue because what I'm really interested into is what is life like a year later?
Yeah.
You know, because Allison is majorly injured in the accident as well. That initial story would have all been about her physical rehabilitation. I didn't really want to tell that story. I wanted to talk about her emotional rehabilitation.
We fill that in anyways. Like, as an audience, we fill all that time in as we watch the movie. Yeah.
Exactly. And similarly, with the accident itself, you know, we couldn't afford to shoot what would have been better. The way I phrase it is the audience's imagination has no budget limit.
Yeah. True. Yeah, true.
So if by not shooting, and I had planned to shoot it, we saved it till the end if we ended up with enough money. But between, you know, all the COVID protocols I ended up I lost a lot of money to testing and the COVID protocols. So I had to shoot the movie in 26 days and I ended up not having enough money to shoot the accident itself, which ultimately I think even if I'd shot it, I probably wouldn't have used it because the second I saw not showing it, I was like, whatever the audience's infinite budget in their minds is going to put in is going to be way better than anything I could shoot at this price point. You know what I mean?
Right. It's the same reason why Seven's so effective, by the way, because Fincher doesn't show the violence. He shows the aftermath and we fill in the violence, which makes it so much.
You had me at Seven. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Dude, we're big Fincher fans.
Listen, I need to promote my film, but I should come back on and we should just do an episode about Seven.
Please,
dude, we should watch Seven together and just talk about it and record it.
That'd Did you insane. Ever talk with Morgan Freeman about Seven?
I didn't talk to Morgan about Seven, but you know, who I talked about Seven with is Johnny C. McGinley, who's, you know, one of my good buddies from Scrubs. And he plays the SWAT guy.
SWAT guy.
And he improvised. Here's a little tidbit for you. He improvised that line at the end when after, you know, the reveal. I don't know why I'm holding back if you haven't seen Seven yet, but at the end the reveal, box? And he's in the chopper and he goes, somebody call somebody. Yeah, Johnny improvised that.
It's fantastic. Wow.
That's hilarious.
Well, I do kind of want to talk about that time jump because
99 out of 100 directors, when they use a title card for a film, it's just to sort of remind people, hey, this is the movie that you're watching. Here's where it begins. Mm. But I feel like your title card is used to really, like, it's such a gut punch and it's such an emotional reaction. And I was wondering if you could talk about, I feel like we don't see enough title cards used to yield a reaction for, like, you hold on to it for a little bit. And then when it hits, it almost it elicits a reaction, and just the art of using a title card to get a reaction out of us.
That's a great, this is a great podcast.
Yeah, you can write.
Can you isolate that audio? Can you isolate that audio, please?
No, your questions are so great, you guys. Yes, I agree. First of all, I hate opening credits. It's a pet peeve of mine. I always have had a reaction to showing all the names of who's in the movie. It's like, always felt like, you know, I'm a big theater geek, and it's like it always felt like the everyone taking a bow before the play started. So I do what's called, for those not in the business, it's called main on ends, which basically means, if you do no one up front, you can then, with the guilds and the unions and everything, get away with doing everyone at the end. So all my films are main on ends. I don't want to see people's names at the beginning of the movie. Mm. I want to show you what we made and then show you all the brilliant people who did it. So part of that is the only thing you have to show is well, I don't know if you even have to show it, but I the only thing you get to show is the title. And I really wanted to delineate that beat was a prologue. Mm. And I think you're right. It is a bit of a gut punch because you're like, whoa, hopefully they have the audience has a reaction you had, which was like, that was all prologue. Now the movie begins. Mm-hmm. Like this was like, we're watching it and hopefully you're enjoying it and you're getting invested in these characters. And then there's something insane happens. And then you're like, whoa, that was prologue. Now we're going to begin the movie. And I just thought that was a really powerful way to do that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very fascinated by narrative decisions in terms of shot choices. Like shots can look cool or they can display a certain visual aspect, but the narrative reasons behind them make them so much more immersive and so much more effective. There's a scene with Daniel and Ryan. I guess I'll set this up a bit because obviously the characters, you know, that's his, you know, the idea of him losing his own daughter and then taking care of his granddaughter and all these things. But this the relationship that they have in the film is interesting because there's such a separation of what as a 16-year-old, what she's going through and him not knowing how to parent her as a grandfather. But there's this amazing moment where she comes downstairs and he's with the train set. And you have this brilliant shot back and forth where the bars of the railing are in between them. Yeah. And it felt like prison bars almost in a way.
Exactly.
And I wanted to ask about the narrative decision behind that shot. It really felt effective. It felt like they were such separated individuals trying to get to each other, but they couldn't. And there's a warmth to that scene that does end that scene where you think maybe they will start to become better and closer. But I just thought it was a shot choice that really affected me. And I'm just curious what your narrative decisions are.
Thank you so much. Actually, I'll give you one step cooler with that shot. The wider size actually has a legit picture of Morgan at 18 in his military uniform for Vietnam. And so that picture on the wall is genuinely his picture. And then it's so it's him at 18 and then her at 16 and then him at 84 in that shot.
Oh my God.
Wow.
That's great.
It's really cool. In terms of the bars, I wish I could say I wrote that in. Well, I always wrote that she has a spot on the stairs. In fact, in the script, I had written that there was a carpeted runner and where she always sits on the steps, you could see that the carpet was worn down. That didn't make it to production. But when we found that location, it had those bars there. And I thought, you know, initially you thought, oh, maybe that's going to be weird. Maybe I need to make her spot that she always sits not on the steps. And then I thought, no, it's brilliant. It's kind of like they're both in their individual prisons, which they are. Why don't I shoot this through the bars? So it was really a happy accident we found on the location. But, you know, now that I've seen it, there's not a single set in the movie. They're all locations. So, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously we decorate them, but we didn't have any money to make to build sets. So, but now that I watch it, I go, oh gosh, if I was to build that set, I would want to use those bars because they were such a happy accident.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Zach, there are obviously some extremely difficult emotional scenes in this movie, and your cast is so incredibly talented. Specifically Florence, she's outstanding. And, yeah. But I would assume that to ask them to go through those moments multiple times is borderline cruel. Yeah. And so I'm curious, as a director, if you're someone who does ask for a number of takes, do you rely heavily on rehearsals? What's it like on the day to shoot some of the more complicated scenes like that?
That's a great question. There's not really rehearsals because we just didn't have time. I mean, there was like, we did one day of with Mauro Fiore, my brilliant DP, doing just some camera tests on Florence. He sort of tried out a couple different lighting styles just for her and her face. And we would talk about where we would kind of, you know, it was just sort of a bit of a test day. We tried out a couple lenses. We tried out different lighting styles that he was thinking about and where they might be good in the movie. There's a bunch of macro stuff in the movie. We played with some macro lenses. But in terms of like acting rehearsal, there was none. One day, because of the haircut, which was just a production clusterfuck, we had to, which meant that it forced us to do the very first day, Chinaza and Florence rolling around in bed together in the beginning. Oh, wow. So I did one day of them. I got like a queen bed and just, you know, I wanted them to get to know each other. So we did sort of rehearse that a little bit so that we weren't just like day one, you know, with name tags on. Hello, my name is Zach, saying, hey, roll around in bed together. Yeah. But that was really it. And in terms of your question about takes, I'm certainly don't have the time to do a ton. I mean, you really have to go quickly. But with the extreme emotional stuff, you go until you got it. And then when you got it, you just move on because, you know, there's, as you guys know from seeing it, there's some performances in this movie that are just incredible. And when those are happening and you got it, you're just like, please tell me that was all in focus. Okay, let's move on.
right.
Because, you know, there are directors out there who have infinite money and time who would go, great, let's go 50 more times.
Fincher.
Yeah, like our hero Fincher.
But 99 takes.
I just don't have I didn't have the budget or for that. So, you know.
Wow. That's even more impressive then.
Yeah.
Zach, like everyone here, I've lived in the awe of the legend that is Morgan Freeman my entire life. And I know that you've worked with him, you've directed him before, but when you're his director, you can't be a fanboy on set. Like you've got to direct the man. And I don't want to say you've got to be his boss, but like, you've got to tell him. So how do you tell Morgan Freeman he's doing something wrong? What is the scariest? What's the scariest? Okay. Let me rephrase. The most scared you've been to give him notes?
Well, the funny thing about Morgan is you do take one and you're like, that was awesome, guys. We're going to go again. And you hear, wah. you know, here's the thing. The truth is I've worked with De Niro as an actor. I've worked with Morgan, Michael Caine, Alan Arkin. I just directed Harrison Ford and Shrinking. I've been so lucky to work with some of these amazing legends. They want to be directed. They don't want someone who's intimidated, who's going to be wide-eyed and afraid of them. That's their nightmare. They want someone with a point of view. They certainly don't want to be told how to act. I would never do that. But it's a conversation. They want to be stimulated by a conversation. And a great actor is mostly focused on the scene in the moment present. They're not looking at, you know, we shoot the whole thing out of order, right? So my job is to look at the macro experience that we're shooting completely out of order and engage in a conversation if it's not fully right. So it's more like, you know, we're just coming from that scene. What do you think? Should we do one that's a little more angry because of what's just happened? And that's how you collaborate as an artist. You're not telling Morgan Freeman and Florence Pugh how to act. They're fucking geniuses. But what you're doing is going, hey guys, I'm the conductor of the orchestra. Should we do one that's a little more XYZ because of what we're going to next? You know, you're engaging in a conversation.
Makes sense.
You know, Zach, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And Roger Deakins, Jake and I were in Toronto a few years ago, and we're at the hotel, and there's a bunch of actors walking by, and then I see Deakins' hair, and I freak out.
I listen to the podcast. I love the podcast. I listen to it.
Yeah, he's amazing.
It's great.
So we run over to him. We talk briefly, and I'm like, "Hey, real quick, I just wanted to always ask you this. On the sides of the frames in Jesse James, you blur out the sides." And I was like, "What is that?" He goes, "There's these lenses I created called deaconizers." And I'm like, "Oh my god, that sounds insane." I'm watching your film, and we're in some sequences where Florence is dealing with the drug use and things like that, and you do blur out aspects of the frame. And I was just curious, were you using something similar? How do you achieve that effect?
That's in camera. Marrow found those. We called them like the opiate lenses, or because they kind of appear in scenes when Florence is high. And that's a Marrow idea. I don't know what the exact lens is. It's not a, I don't think it's a Panavision. But, you know, most of our lenses were Panavision anamorphics. I'm not exactly sure if that particular lens was a Panavision lens or not, but it's all in camera. It's the only spot that's in perfect focus is in the center. So it's really cool and trippy. And I just love that it was an in-camera lens thing, not a post thing.
Yeah, and it created an effect in the audience. And then just a quick follow-up on that, there's a shot that I was curious how you did it, because lighting is such a fascinating thing to me, and the adjustments that have to be made in a shot. It's a simple scene in terms of like what I'm about to ask, but I'm curious how hard it was to achieve. We have this moment where Florence is sitting in a dark living room, and Molly Shannon's character gets home, and she walks in and opens up the window, right? And normally when you're going from dark to light like that, I would imagine that could be a tough shot to pull off, to keep the shot the way you want it to keep it. And I was just curious, is that a complicated shot, or am I overthinking it in terms of like the way the lighting affects the image and kind of what we're seeing in that moment?
No, I think if you committed to, it would probably be trickier if you needed the outside to expose. I think that Marrow just committed to blowing the fuck out of that window. So
it looked great.
It's hiding behind that curtain, you know, that extreme, whatever fixture he has out there. And then we had some atmosphere in the air, which is always great when you're going to blow out a window like that. And sometimes you'll get great shafts. We did that a lot in Going in Style. Because we had budget in that bank, we just these huge like 20Ks coming through the window with a little bit of atmosphere, and you get those awesome shafts of light. So we did a little bit of atmosphere in the air, and then I think when there was obviously there's probably some light fixture on Florence, and there's the TV lighting gag effect on her. But I think when Molly opens the curtains, we just let it just go totally blown out and bright.
Reminded me like Kaminsky, like Spielberg does that a lot in like Bridge of Spies, for example, and just blow the light out. It's so cool.
And also, do you remember that movie Clockers?
Oh, dude, yeah. I love Clockers, Spike man. Lee. Hell yeah.
Spike Lee went through a phase. He was using, it was DP, I forgot who it was, but he was using a filter that was really popular back in the day called Black Promist. And he used it like crazy in Clockers. So it has this effect. We didn't use it on this film, but it has this really cool effect of just blowing out highlights and Spike Lee went through a phase where he was doing that like crazy.
It looks awesome.
The perfect Real Blend guest, by the way. Yeah, I hope, man. You know, like you fit in, like you could be like the fourth.
Guys, can this I just join the show? I want to join the show.
We'd love to have you.
Are you free next week?
This is literally our show every time we record. Yeah.
Well, it's great, Zach, for me, because I love the tech stuff, and I love the storytelling stuff. So I can talk like about this stuff all day.
So you and I are basically the same age. We grew up at a time.
You're 21.
Yes. Can you imagine? I'm going to have my first legal drink tonight. Malibu and orange. I've had it planned for years. Grease was everything, and you are now in a commercial where you get to pay homage to Grease with John Travolta.
Well, and not only that, I mean, I'm a musical theater kid. I went to musical theater camp. I mean, I love theater. I love musicals. I love singing. I can't dance, but I love watching people dance. So that was
that experience alone has to be that was had really, to be.
Yeah, it was really surreal. And we never thought it would happen. You know, we were pitched it without Travolta. And, you know, because Donald and I do a campaign for T-Mobile. And then it kind of went away. And then it came back to us like, Travolta's in. We were like, what? so that was really cool.
Vincent Vega?
We, He was amazing. Donald and I, before we, you know, we shot 2 days, and right before, like in the, right before day one, I took Donald aside. I'm like, dude, you gotta be cool. Like, don't go like asking the guy all these questions, like be chill. And he's like, yeah, I got it. 10 seconds in, he's got Travolta in the corner and he's asking him questions about Face Off. And I'm like, I was like, you are so not cool. We just talked about this.
No, that's all.
But
of
then,
us,
then it was cool. Later, then when we got to know him and he was so cool and chill, I started asking him Pulp Fiction questions, and he was telling me, you guys will love this. He's like, I was like, can you just tell me something about the dance sequence in Pulp Fiction? He's like, well, you know, I won twist competitions as a kid, and Tarantino knew that. So originally it was just the twist, and I was like, Quentin, I'm doing my bad John Travolta office voice, but he's like, Quentin, there were a lot of other, dances from that time. Like, and he starts demonstrating them for Tarantino. And he's like, if you want, I can teach these all to Uma, and then she can just follow, copy me and do whatever I do on the day. And he's like, Tarantino loved it. So that's what happened. So Travolta basically turned that from just the twist into that amazing sequence.
You know, in addition to loving your work as a director in film, I really love all the work that you've done in television. Obviously, you've done Ted Lasso, and you got Shrinking, and I believe you did 7 episodes of Scrubs, if I'm not wrong. But I was just wondering, there are a lot of episodes you didn't direct. Is there one episode in particular that you most wish, like, God, like, I would have liked to have seen? Not saying you would have done it better, but you just would have liked to have seen maybe what you would have done with that material.
That's a really awesome question. We got to a certain point where Bill was giving me all the big ones, you know, he would splurge like once or twice a year, and make a big sort of mega episode. And so he would really give me kind of the juiciest ones. I didn't do the musical, but I Will McKenzie did that, a legendary TV director. I wouldn't have had to do that as well as Will did. I don't know. I can't think of one. Because I kind of feel like I got the best ones for the most part.
Mm. Zach, were you thrilled seeing Brendan win?
Oh, I love that guy. And it's just, you know, fans should know there's just not a sweeter person in the world. He really is that humble, menschy guy. And, you know, he did that little arc for us on Scrubs, and it's like the most beloved thing in Scrubs history. People,
oh my God,
people love, that's like universally everyone's favorite episode is that funeral episode.
Right.
You know, I think filmmaking and acting and all type of storytelling has the ability to be extremely cathartic, especially and therapeutic in a very interesting way. From an audience perspective, we gain our own catharsis and our own therapeutic aspects from storytelling. But as a filmmaker, to tell a story and then, you know, now you're promoting it, but at the end of the production, I'm curious, what's the biggest catharsis you found in yourself through this movie? I'm wondering, like, what is the biggest change you maybe made in your life because of this film? Like, did it help you work through certain things? Because I feel like making a movie, especially in this particular context with these thematics, could be some of the best therapy anybody could go through, just because I feel like you're letting it all out. And I'm just curious how you gained from it.
Well, that's well said. I think that I'm finding as I tour the country and share the film that this is where I find the most catharsis and joy, actually, because this film is so personal and so raw, and you know, you hope that people have the reaction to it like you guys have had to it. You know, I do these Q&As as we go around city to city, and watching the last half hour of the movie with people, and then having these wonderful conversations about people's interpretations and what people took from it, and of course their own experiences of grief and loss. That's where it finally feels, you know, you feel community. You feel, you know, I think when you're at these moments in your life, you can feel so lonesome. And so to finally feel, to share it with people and have them have the reaction like you guys have had is where you feel great. You feel like, oh, it reminds you that you're not alone in these feelings.
Zach, we're so happy to have you on as a guest. We're told we're out of time, but
I could talk to you guys all day. This was awesome.
Well, you have me in a little bit, so I'm glad that this didn't go horribly wrong, because that would have made it an awkward TV.
And by the way, Florence's AA speech That might be one of the most incredible performances I've seen from an actor in a long time. I can't even imagine what that was like for you behind the camera to watch that, because that was, I mean, I literally was tearing up. That was a brilliant sequence.
I know I'm biased, but I'm in awe of her. And I think that monologue is one of the best things I've ever seen ever.
It was incredible.
It really is amazing.
The three of us are really just humbled that we get an opportunity to shine a brighter spotlight on this movie, because
thank you
we
for
want
doing
as
that.
Many
really
people
appreciate
to see it,
it
as
thank
possible.
You. And please go to see it in the theaters, folks. It's you know, people always say they don't make movies like this anymore. And I've tried to make one for you. So please go to the theater and check it out.
We want to thank Zach Braff for coming on the show. I think I told you guys Garden State was my number one the year that it came out. And so to get a chance to speak to him and have him on our show, I think was really, really great. And I think he genuinely enjoyed being on the show. I think he really had a good time.
I didn't back that up.
Yeah. So you got to go to him later on in the day.
Yeah. So when we interviewed him, he was actually in Chicago on a PA tour for A Good Person. And the way the situation worked was I needed to be in my studio to do the Zoom. And then once we wrapped, I went across town to the hotel he was at and actually interviewed him in person for my morning show here in Chicago. And whenever I walked in, the first thing he said to me was, just so you know, no interview we're about to do is going to top what we just did for the podcast. And I was like, oh, I'm fully aware. And then even the crew around, we were all captivated by, look, I'm not trying to like pat us on the back, but he went on for a bit about like how great that conversation was. And in fact, the thing he said I thought was great, because he listens to other podcasts, he said the closest, he goes, I've been looking for a podcast like you guys, and the closest that I have found is Roger Deakins' podcast. Oh, so make geez. Of that what you will.
Oh my gosh. Deakin shoots digitally, though. We all know that that's a problem. We all know that's going to be an issue. All right, we are going to get right to this week in movies, because there's three big titles that we want to get to. And the first one I'm going to throw to my great friend Kevin McCarthy, because it's a film called Tetris that's available on Apple TV Plus. It stars Taron Egerton. And if you think that it's a tricky name for something, it's not. It's about the game Tetris. Yeah. But Kev's been raving about this since he saw it. So tell us why it's important, Kev.
Well, I was blown away by it because I didn't expect it to. I didn't know the story. I mean, I don't know who to credit this to, but someone put it the best way possible. They were like, if Bridge of Spies and Argo and Social Network had a baby, that's what this movie would be. And I'm like, that is the best description I could think of for this film. I had no clue that this all went down before the game, you know, in terms of like the game being released. And Taron Egerton's character, he plays a businessman named Hank Rogers, and he teams up with the creator of the game. And essentially they're in the USSR fighting for the rights of this game. And it's honestly feels like, if you could imagine the end of Argo when they're trying to get out of the country, like, again, I don't want to, you know, put two and two in the same aspect, because, you know, they're both relatively serious. Argo was very, very serious. So was Tetris in terms of like what they were dealing with behind the scenes. But there was some really insane things happening with the rights to this game that I had absolutely no idea. And one of the cool things about the film is just seeing how the gaming aspect worked. Like, they had to get rights for the arcade, they had to get rights for the home systems, they had to get rights for, you know, Game Boy. And like, there's like a scene where Hank Rogers sees a Game Boy for the first time, and it's like so cool to like see kind of how all that goes down. But when I knew they were making a movie about Tetris, I'm like, I loved that game because I found it cathartic and therapeutic, because it would just be nice to watch the blocks disappear and things like that. But I did not know anything about what went down in terms of getting that game out. It's beautifully shot. Like, they use a lot of really cool animations in the film where like they'll go to an establishing shot of a city or whatever, and it'll be in block formation, then it'll disappear, and then you enter wherever you are.
That's kind of cool.
It's really clever, and Taron is unbelievable. It's probably one of my favorite performances he's probably done since Kingsman. And yeah, listen, I loved him in Rocketman, but this was really interesting. Like, sometimes a mustache, while like, you know, it sounds like a small thing, it really does give him a different characteristic, the way he talks, the way he moves and performs. And I was just, yeah, it was just a kind of a shock to me. Again, the three movies that I mentioned, it has the same beats, in my opinion, in terms of the way the score is used, like Social Network. It feels like it's moving along like Social Network in terms of thematics and like the rights to it and kind of who's coming up with it and where who has rights to what. And the Argo aspect comes from the intensity of getting out and actually getting home safe, because there's actually a lot of intensity involved. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm sure they had to take artistic liberties. I'm sure certain things didn't happen exactly how it happened in the film. It's the same, you know, same thing with, you know, with Michael Jordan, the Air film. I mean, there's so many different, they're going to take artistic liberties but keep the story core. So for me, I loved it. It's going to be on Apple TV Plus this weekend. Highly recommend it. It was just, now again, what's weird is, you know, when you sometimes you sit down and watch a movie, you don't know what to expect. Sometimes it just wows you and that kind of gives you an elevated sense of what you just watched. Now that I'm kind of pumping it up to you guys, I'm curious if it still lands that way, because I didn't know going in what it was. Mm-hmm. And so that description that I heard later on, I was like, oh, wow, that to me is, put that on the poster. That's a selling point to the movie. I would, if someone told me there was those three films combined, I would watch it in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so I loved it. I was highly impressed with it. It scored incredibly. And like, it was just a wild story that I never knew. And like, it's a game that I've known all my life. I had a Game Boy. I had, you know, that was a game that I used to just rock out on my Game Boy. And to know what went into it and people's lives that were at stake and people's careers and families, like it's just insane. So mm-hmm. I was very impressed with it.
Well, it's called Tetris. It's available on Apple TV again. So if you have a subscription to that, be sure to go check it out. I want to start off with A Good Person, which is Zach Braff's film, as we've been talking about him before. And I was floored by this movie.
Florence.
You stretched hard on that one.
Florence Pugh's in the movie, for people who don't know.
It's hard to, like, can we talk about the catalyst of the story? Is that,
it's in the
is
trailer.
That known?
It's in
is
the trailer.
It? Okay. Yeah. All right. So essentially it follows Florence Pugh's character after she's been involved in a car accident. She's the driver. She has two of her close friends in the car with her. She survives, but they die. And they have a child that they leave behind because the kid was at school when the accident happens. And what I thought was really, really smart, and Braff talked about this in the interview, was that instead of dealing with the immediate aftermath and how would you come back from something like that physically, the film jumps forward a year and starts to figure out where all these characters are. Still dealing with the aftermath of it. And it has some incredible performances from people who you would expect. Florence Pugh is easily one of the best actresses working today. And as much
Wait
as
till
I
you
know,
see her in Oppenheimer as Jean Tatlock.
Take a drink. As much as I know she's great, I'm still floored, you know, when I see her in something like this, because she's incredible. Her character is dealing with a drug addiction, and there's an element of being stuck in her hometown and how the accident kind of prevented her from moving on from it. And Braff's screenwriting is as honest and authentic as I think it could be in these really, like, I think he admits he was going through some tough emotional times while he was working on the script. And all of that comes through in the dialogue and the situations that these characters go through. And then someone like Morgan Freeman comes in, or even Molly Shannon, who's terrific. And you just, if you give performers of their caliber decent material, they can make it phenomenal. So when you give them really great dramatic material, they can be off the charts. And I think everybody in this is kind of off the charts. And so I didn't expect going into it to like this as much as I did. I was really, really, really impressed by it. And I was, like I said, Zach Braff directed a couple of things after Garden State. After Garden State, I was dying to see what he did next. And I forget the names of the movies that he did, but I just remember them,
like,
not
like
really.
Wish I Was Here.
That was one he did with Josh Gad. Is that the one he did with Josh Gad?
Going in Style.
Right. And they were okay.
But he's also done a lot of great television work. Like, he directs Ted Lasso. He did Shrinking.
Absolutely, yes. And some key episodes of yeah. Scrubs, which is...
Wait, was Going in Style was the one with Michael Caine, right?
Yep.
Yes. Because I'll never forget that, because I remember I was doing that junket and I was Wikipedia-ing Michael Caine to find out something, and I looked at his his birth name. Do you guys know Michael Caine's real name?
No.
And this is not a joke. And that sounds like a setup to a joke, but it's not. His name is Maurice Joseph Micklewhite. That is his actual name. And really? I asked him, I have to go back and find the video, but he told me there's a whole story about how he came up with it. I think it had something to do with him being in a phone booth and the Caine Mutiny was playing on a theater in front of him. I think he was funny. On the phone with his agent or something. And he's like, yeah, call me Michael Caine. I have to go back and watch it. I don't want to. I hope that's pretty great. Might be accurate, but it is really funny. Anyways, that just reminded me of that. But go ahead.
There's a number of stars who don't go by, like Emma Stone is actually named Emily.
Is she?
Because, yeah, her real name is Emily. But when she came to Hollywood, there was an Emily Stone. And so she had to change it. So she changed it to Emma.
Like Whoopi Goldberg's not her name, right? And I don't think, is Johnny Depp his real name?
I don't know. These are good questions.
Nicholas Cage, Nicholas Coppola.
Jonathan Depp.
You know Nicholas Cage's last name is, isn't it based off of Luke Cage?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Luke
specifically.
Luke Cage, and then he said it was someone else, right? It was cool. There's two things that it's referencing. It's Luke Cage, and then there was one other reference. Anyway, yeah.
There's a lot of people who don't know he's a Coppola. I was surprised by that.
I didn't know that until fairly recently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, so go ahead.
Anywho, Zach Braff's new movie is really good, and it's called The Good Person, and you guys should definitely check it out. You guys want to throw anything else into it, or should we?
I guess all I'll say is that there were so many moments in this movie that like could have fallen into the cliche sort of melodrama. Like, the actual plot itself isn't necessarily anything new, and it's, you know, but there are so many moments where it felt like there was a fork in the road in terms of like, is this going to be a Lifetime movie of the week, or do you have something real to say, something authentic to say with actors who can give real and authentic performances? And luckily he took the road less traveled, because every moment where I felt like, okay, here we go, like this is going to happen, and then it was sort of like oh, that's interesting and fresh, refreshing, and feels genuine, and this feels like real people behaving in a real way, and not like characters who were playing out a dramatic point for point plot in a movie. So it really felt like I was just impressed at how, I guess this is going to sound weird, but like how bad this movie could have been.
Yeah,
but in retrospect, like, it's not just not bad, it's actually really great. And I honestly think it's one of Morgan Freeman's best performances in a very long time. Not saying, I mean, he doesn't give bad performances. Even a like halfway decent Morgan Freeman performance is better than anything most actors could do. But this feels like he was tapping into some things that we haven't really seen him do in a while, if ever.
I like the point you made in the interview about the jump in time for a year, because that was a fascinating way, because then you're right, because it would have been a completely different film had we had gone through that year. And we can just fill in those gaps anyways as we watch the film moving forward. But the whole train and city aspect thing that Morgan's character creates is really interesting. The whole relationship with his granddaughter is fascinating. We pointed out some of the interesting shots in the film with like the prison bars, and there's some really interesting thematic choices that are made from a shot perspective that really work. I thought Molly Shannon was great.
Yep.
She plays her mother. Tough role. There's a scene with her in the bathroom with Florence, which is really, and then Florence gives this incredible speech at AA that is really just a phenomenal sequence. I mean, really kind of just solidifies how amazing of an actor she is. It's a great character drama. It's just a really solid drama, and that works well. That's cathartic and therapeutic, as Zach has talked about in his interviews. So yeah, I was very impressed with it. It shot really well, but I'm with Jake. Like, it's one of Morgan Freeman's best performances in a long time.
So John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein did, Game Night. I keep messing that up.
So good.
And of course, John Francis Daly is from Freaks and Geeks, and they did the Vacation film. They're primarily known for comedies. But here they are taking a big swing with Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, and going for the sort of sci-fi fantasy element, big budget fantasy, with what I think it has going for it is the perfect cast. I think everyone in this ensemble is picked for exactly what they're supposed to do. Chris Pine, who I have said repeatedly on this show and Dungeons and Dragons confirms it, he's the best Chris. He's my favorite Chris. He's the best Chris. And he told me in our interview, he said, this is a movie that's made up of movie moments. He says, you've seen them before. You already know basically what's going to happen. He goes, it's right down to the point where you know how the camera's going to move. You know how certain lines have to be delivered. But he goes, some actors chafe at that. I kind of relish it. He goes, because I want to do it in the way that, he goes, when I work on big tentpole things like this, like I'm pretending to be Harrison Ford. And so he's giving an Indiana Jones-esque performance, and Michelle Rodriguez is bringing everything that she does incredibly well to her part. And Regé Jean Page, who is still, you know, kind of untested, but is really good in the part that he has. He's the one who's sort of saddled with all the jargon. He's the knight who's taking things extremely seriously as these guys are on their quest. I want to let people know that there's nothing super meta about it. It's not like you don't step out of the game and it's other people playing Dungeons and Dragons. It's legitimately just, hey, here's a campaign and how it would kind of play out. And I was blown away by how much fun I had with this. I just thought it moved so well. I thought the set pieces were incredibly creative. I thought the visual effects looked fantastic. And as I mentioned, I just think the ensemble was chosen perfectly. Like Hugh Grant being the smarmy villain. I thought everybody was chosen to do exactly what they do really, really well. And they fit perfectly into the template. Kev, I know that you were a huge fan of this. What worked the best for you?
I loved it. I was so surprised. It's probably my biggest surprise this year so far. Mm. I just didn't expect anything from it because I'm not a Dungeons and Dragons fan. I didn't play the game. And I just remember sitting down in the theater, it was sold out. And there was a video that came on the screen from the cast all talking about the importance of the theatrical experience. And, you know, what they said are things that we say all the time. But then to sit in the theater with a crowd like that and watch the reactions to it was just so much fun. And like, what's brilliant about the film, and similar in tone to Game Night, where it is seriously grounded in actual thematics, but also funny and over the top in a very fun way. But it doesn't, like you said, like it's not meta. It's actually just really interesting character development and good writing. And Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez are so great together. Sophia Ellis, if I have her name right, and also Justice Smith, they're great in the film. And Hugh Grant, as you mentioned, the villain is terrifying. I was really engaged with just the group. I want to watch these core four, I guess Scream 6 already coined that term, core four characters, I want to continue watching them in other versions of this. Like, I genuinely cared for them. I genuinely cared for the thematics of failure and kind of what they were dealing with, and Chris Pine's character and what he wanted to do to get back his family. But also the action is spectacular. Did I say Sophia Lillis?
Lillis.
I couldn't tell if you said Lillis or Ellis. It sounded like you said Ellis, but Lillis.
Oh, I might have said that. Okay, cool. Yeah. My fault. Our brains are all a little fried.
No, you're fine.
The movie, I was just very happy with the action, the comedy, the shot choices. There's some really cool wonders in the film, really clever ways to play with the action in terms of going like in and out of frozen moments in time. And like this, it's just really interesting and fun. And the world building is great. I was so happy with this experience. It just made me happy. I had so much fun with it. I loved it.
Cool. Jake, where are you at?
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. We were talking about just sort of the vibe that it gives us. And I've been telling people that it sort of made me feel like I felt whenever I went and saw The Mummy for the first time, the Brendan Fraser Mummy, or even like, honestly, like Pirates of the Caribbean, that, you know, we keep talking about how much this, I remember seeing Pirates for the first time and sort of just being surprised at just how fun it was, because I didn't really know what to expect. Like, it's a movie based on a Disney ride. So like, what is this going to be? And that's kind of how I felt. Like, this is based on a role-playing game. What does that mean? Now, that being said, I've told that you guys that a buddy of mine for his birthday recently wanted us to do a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, which now I honestly am a little bit more grateful at having that experience, because there were moments that I felt like I appreciated it maybe a little bit more. By no means do I have any kind of encyclopedic knowledge, but they did pack my theater full of local Chicago Dungeons and Dragons players. And that gave me such an appreciation for how many levels this movie has.
Yeah.
Because there were so many moments
that people in the theater like lit up or laughed at or pointed things out that I had no idea what it was. And the movie was still working for me, but I'm assuming that there is so much stuff in that movie that just went over my head.
Same.
So for them to kind of layer things for, you know, a guy who played D&D one time a month ago, or for someone who's never played D&D, or for people who grew up their entire lives playing D&D, that's a lot of different plates to spin at one time. And to do that with the charm and the precision and the craft. And one thing I just want to end on saying that I had such a true, genuine appreciation for was the amount of practical effects.
Yep.
Like there was there, like, look, yes, obviously there are moments where they have to use CGI and it's a big fat dragon. Of course it's going to be CGI, but there are so many creatures that could have been CGI that instead they built or did makeup for or whatever the case. And that, like, it honestly, it even like threw me back to like a Princess Bride kind of vibe to it. So like the fact that they didn't take those shortcuts, all those little things added up to something really special. And I, this is the most I would say I've been worried and just genuinely hope that this movie does well. I don't know how it's tracking, only just because selfishly I want to see another one. And if this is the only one that we see in the series, it would be such a waste.
We were talking about this earlier with Shazam and how Shazam didn't do quite as well. And I honestly think it's because people are holding on to some money to be able to go see John Wick and this. I think the buzz around this is pretty high and the reviews out of South By were really positive and the marketing has been good on it. So I think this is going to do well.
And can we just take a second here, because we are a film podcast, to celebrate how insane the box office was for John Wick? I mean, we're talking about a film that as of the day of recording this has made $146 million since its release. It came out, what, four or five days ago. And for a film to be 2 hours and 49 minutes plus trailers to crush. And we said this in our review last week. It's one of the best action films I have ever seen. It is a brilliant, brilliant film from a filmmaking standpoint.
Fourth movie in a popular franchise, though.
Yeah, but you have to. I will say this, though. I think a lot of us after three, there was a little bit of a fatigue of like, oh, it's the same type of action stuff over and over again. Sure. But four really hit a stride that that hadn't been hit, in my opinion, since one. And I love all of them. I go 4, 1, 2, 3. But I genuinely just want to give Chad Stahelski a shout out just because like it's
he's probably listening.
The if you listen to our interview with him. Just listen to how dedicated he is to the exact details of every single little thing in the film, from the costumes to the every single thing of training and it all pays off. Hard work pays off.
You're forgetting just amazing. The important element, too, that was added is Donnie Yen. Just put Donnie Yen in everything.
Donnie Yen.
And make him blind.
His performance in that movie is unfreaking believable.
It's great.
Oh,
Gabriel.
The recent projections I'm seeing for Dungeon 3-Day are 27 to 36 million.
Ooh, I don't feel like that's as good.
And compare that again. I want Dungeons to do well because it's awesome, but that's a PG-13 film based on a very, very popular game. And then you look at John Wick, which I think did 73 million. Again, I know fourth film in. R-rated.
John Wick could hold on to number one.
Yeah. I think it will.
And you know, it feels like Paramount is a little aware of people's, I think, honestly, lack of interest, because I've seen so many ads that sort of say things like, come on, you know you're curious. And like, look at the rate, look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, and like, come on. Like, and so I'm like, God,
wouldn't it hurt you to see a movie?
Come on. Just throw a couple of shekels our way.
We do a movie show. It's a great movie. Dungeons is awesome. It's awesome. Yeah.
These figures are from Box Office Pro, and I'll say that this is the 24th is when they updated this, and it's a 14% increase from the week before. So it's increasing.
It's going upwards.
It's trending positive. So
yeah,
by the time we get to the weekend, is it even more? Is it set for like a?
And it has like 2 weeks to perform before Sonic hits, and I think Sonic is the next thing that might give it.
Sonic?
Mario.
Thank you.
I legit just paused and went, is there another Sonic movie?
Sonic 3.
Sorry. Yeah,
surprise.
Sorry. Mario. Isn't
Mario is going to dominate through April.
Is the Mario embargo up or no?
I don't think so.
No. Okay.
I don't think so.
I am very excited to talk about that when we finally can.
Well, in the meantime, we have to say goodbye to Kevin because he's got an interview he has to go jump to do, even though it's late on a Tuesday. Just to show you guys how
dedicated are you interviewing someone in Australia?
I believe I am. Is he in New Zealand or Australia?
He's in Australia.
Okay.
Is his favorite Brandon Lee movie The Crow?
Russell the Crow. That's pretty good. I'm not gonna lie.
Say hello to Maximus for us.
Maximus.
And Kevin did record his blend game. So let's take a quick break here, and when we return, Jake and myself will round out Hugh Grant blend with a recorded video.
Maybe
by Kev.
I don't want to. Maybe I'm done with the show too.
You already talked to Russell Crowe. You have to come back. True. You're contractually obligated to return.
Yeah.
Show me that paperwork, sir.
And we are back. Okay, so the blend game with relation to Hugh Grant showing up as the villain for Dungeons & Dragons is hashtag Hugh Grant blend. I personally believe that there's only one choice that you can make for this, so I'll wait and see if Jake Hamilton has selected it. Jake, where'd you go?
So Hugh Grant is very much the epitome of a rule in this game that we often talk about, which is we're not picking our favorite movie that this particular person has been in, but the best that they've been and maybe a great example of what it is that they do best kind of thing. Because you guys know my obsession with Cloud Atlas, but that doesn't feel like the right answer to choose for Hugh Grant. Like that's okay. Not like I don't love Cloud Atlas because of Hugh Grant. I think he's great in it. But I don't love Cloud Atlas because of Hugh Grant. Same thing with Love Actually. Like, I love Love Actually, and he's such a great part of Love Actually. But, like, I feel weird choosing Love Actually when he's just a small part of the ensemble.
What you're saying is if the aliens were landing and you had the to aliens show were them landing. A strong
yes.
Hugh Grant
I
example.
Know that frame of thought annoys the shit out of Gabe, but that frame of thought has helped me make so many decisions on this show. So if the aliens were coming down,
Cloud Atlas.
I wouldn't show them. Well, I'd show them Cloud Atlas if they want to see a great film. But if they want to see a Hugh Grant film and what makes Hugh Grant great, I feel like you got to show them Notting Hill.
Okay.
Which to me is the perfect example of what he does best, which is that awkward sort of everyman that's a little bit charming, but a little bit befuddled, a little bit sort of out of his element. And I think the foil of both the charm and the talent of Julia Roberts, but the foil of his type of character opposite such a big, glamorous movie star, and the two of them sort of how they still fit together in such a way that we buy it. Like, it's such a story that just doesn't seem like it could happen in the realm of possibility. Like, you know, it would, you know, the equivalent of like Zendaya walking in your bookstore and all of a sudden her falling for you. Like, but you watch this movie and you go, okay, like I don't not buy it. I think he's charming. I think he's fantastic. And the bonus being that there is such a beautiful, hilarious, incredible tip of the cap to anyone who knows how junkets work.
Yes.
In the end.
I was going to ask you, do you know the publication that he works for?
Horse and Hound.
Yes, it is.
Horse and Hound.
Nice job.
So I think that is the epitome of quintessential Hugh Grantness.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I more think that in time, Hugh Grant evolved into less of the dorky bit that he was doing in the beginning. And embraced more of the pompous asshole. And so I think that you can do the charming, but also arrogant Hugh Grant, in which case Paddington 2 is the greatest thing that he's ever done.
Nick Cage and Pedro Pascal would agree.
Yes, they would.
Such a good as scene.
Would, as such would a good scene. Many, many other people because Paddington 2... What I love about that is that I told you guys that Paddington 2 is terrific. And then for some reason, it has permeated the zeitgeist. And now everybody kind of everywhere recognizes how great it is. It's not unlike what he's doing in Dungeons & Dragons, although in Dungeons & Dragons, it is so exaggerated. He's playing the exaggerated version of Hugh Grant. Paddington 2 takes what he does. He's an old former movie star who now is relegated to doing like dog food commercials and opening up county fairs type of thing. And it's such a blow to his ego. And he allows his persona to be ridiculed, you know, in all the best ways possible. He leans so hard into the joke and he's so, so good at it. And I think that's what's great about Hugh Grant. I think Hugh Grant totally understands what he does and he understands how people perceive him. And that's why even because I'm looking ahead to the audience picks and I see that Josh Mann said the 15 seconds that he did in Glass Onion. That's great. Like Hugh Grant knows exactly what he can do and just does it, you know, usually to perfection. And I think Paddington, too, when he's playing the sinister bad guy, ups what Nicole Kidman did in the first one and just embraces everything that I love about the smarmy, distrustful, yet still kind of charming Hugh Grant. So
so this podcast is a place of truth. And this podcast is where we are friends and we can share things, sometimes even things that we are ashamed of. I have never seen Paddington 2.
I mean, that's sad. It's more sad than it is anything because
you've seen Paddington,
you're cheating
though, right?
Yourself.
No, I've
you not seen Paddington
that.
1?
No. You're cheating. You've seen 1 before 2?
No.
You should watch them both. They're both great. 1 is also incredibly charming.
1 is incredible. And 2 is off the charts good.
Yeah, it's really one of the things. Look, I remember when it came out. Good. Like people, I remember like there were quotes that basically were like, if you did your top 10 list this year and didn't see Paddington 2, then your top 10 list doesn't matter. Like I remember people, you know, it's just one of those things that like, and I'm sure you guys, Dick Cage included. I'm sure like you guys have movies like this in your life where like, you know, it's good. And you know, if you sit down and watch it, you're going to like it. You just can't bring yourself to sit down and watch it. Like if I have like a free night and I, you know, I'm behind on Succession or I'm behind on this or that, like it's going to be really hard for me to go. It's a Paddington night.
I know
what you're saying,
but that night will come.
The night will come. That Paddington
night
will come.
Remind yourself that it's worth watching a double feature of, I will mention before we throw to Kevin, two honorable mentions that I have that I don't know that I could pick
Cloud
between.
House.
One is a movie I don't know how many times I've seen. It was like a family favorite rom-com, and that is 2 Weeks Notice.
Oh, interesting.
Sandra Bullock was a staple, and Hugh Grant was a staple in our house, and they're both in that movie together, and they're both charming and wonderful. But also, I think one of the first movies I remember crying to, like I remember like a movie making me cry about Cloud a boy. House.
Yes, I was hoping you were going to say that.
Great
about
answer.
A boy. Terrific.
Great answer.
Yes, really good performance by him.
Music and lyrics.
Yes. Yeah. Also really good. Yes. Yeah. Also really good. Hugh Grant. National
also
treasure.
Cloud Atlas.
Also his red carpet interview at the Oscars most recently.
We're just going to go through. I got IMDb pulled up.
All right. So audience picks, Josh Mann.
Let me throw
it to Kevin. So Kevin did record a pick and so here it is.
All right, guys, my blend game pick this week for Hugh Grant has got to be Notting Hill. I mean, Notting Hill to me was one of my favorite romantic comedies of all time. It's a film that I remember seeing multiple times. I loved it in theaters. But I also just love that it kind of deals with this concept and this fantasy aspect of what it would be like if you were to date somebody who is like that particularly famous. And again, I don't think fame has anything to do with in terms of attraction or making somebody more attractive, but there's something interesting about the concept of a major movie star dating a somebody who's not at all in the spotlight. And I just always found that juxtaposition really interesting because they're both human beings at the same time. But Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant are just so fantastic in that film. And Risa Fons, I've got to mention him because he's the roommate of Hugh Grant's character, who's great in the movie as well, that bathroom scene. But Grant just plays that role perfectly. It's like it's just a really interesting character because just a normal dude, you know, he works and, you know, lives and doesn't even really think about celebrity at all. And obviously the person he meets and falls in love with happens to be one of the most famous people on the planet. And then to have Julia Roberts playing that character, who's obviously one of the most famous people on the planet as well, their chemistry was just incredible, and Grant just played it masterfully. And I think, again, there's a scene in that film that speaks to me now. And when I was younger, I don't know if I necessarily got it as much, was with the junket scenario where he shows up to one of her press junkets and pretends that he's a reporter for Horse and Hound, which years later I got to when I slated an interview with Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson. I said Kevin McCarthy from Horse and Hound. So it was kind of like a full circle for that. But Grant just kind of plays that role perfectly. And when it comes to that movie, it's just, it's the first movie I think about when I think of him. I do want to point out more recently, he was great in The Gentlemen. It's a, you know, really messed up character, but a really interesting character that he played in Guy Ritchie's film. But Notting Hill has got to be my pick. And it's a film that still, to me, stands up today in terms of just it still plays in an entertaining way. I have to go back and make sure some of the comedy and or some of those bits might not have stood the test of time. But I mean, just in general, the story and the concept of it has always been thrilling to me. And I just love those two characters together. And it's just a fun watch. So my pick is Notting Hill.
Thank you, Kevin. As for audience picks, I already mentioned that Josh Mann said Glass Onion, the 15 seconds or less of perfection. Sathish Godi agreed with me and said Paddington 2. Shrek's very own says D&D Honor Among Thieves. Oh, Shrek got an early screening of D&D. Yeah. There you go.
Well, they did do like a paid screening. In AMC theaters. They're doing for Air, if you're depending on when you're listening to this.
Right.
Saturday, April 1st, they're doing one for Air.
Nice.
Carrie says, what?
I want to pull an Audible.
And?
Why? What?
I want you guys to guess what the IMDb 4 for Hugh Grant is.
Oh, I was just looking at it, so I know it.
Okay, right, Sean.
I'll play. I'm going to say Notting Hill.
Okay.
I'm going to say Love Actually.
Okay.
I'm going to say Music and Lyrics. And I'm going to say probably like Sense and Sensibility.
2 out of 4. Not bad.
Hey, not bad.
Not bad. Okay. This 4 feels very much like someone on his team went to IMDb and was like, these are the 4 It's a great 4. Love Actually, About a Boy, 4 Weddings and a Funeral, and Notting Hill.
4 Weddings and a Funeral. That I knew it was like a stuffier English movie.
Yeah.
Not that that's very stuffy. All right, so Carrie said 2 weeks' notice. Michael Breen also said Notting Hill. Ariel Pace went with Sense and Sensibility, and a lot of love across the board for The Gentleman from Michael Knipp, Ray Perkin, and many
others.
Was that The Gentleman? Was that the Guy Ritchie one that just came out?
Yeah, with
McConaughey?
McConaughey. Do you remember? Do you not remember Hugh Grant? He plays the.
I did not see it. I never got a chance to check it out.
No, you did see it. You did see it. You and I watched it together.
In St. Louis. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. That's right.
It's great.
No, I don't remember Hugh Grant in it.
You should rewatch it. He plays the guy who the through line story is. He's with. And he's just very done up and very, it's like a, he's just kind of chewing that character up. He's so fun.
That's right. I do remember seeing that. Okay.
Worth a rewatch if you're forgetting it, because it's still good.
For next week, you can reach out on Twitter or let us know your pick via email. realblend@cinemablend.com. We're going to be playing #videogamemovieblend.
Ooh.
So
does it have to be video game movie?
I was thinking just adapted and somehow connected to a video game, right? Does that make sense? Like Resident Evil's are video game movies, even though it's not.
Sure. But I mean, I'm.
But like Jumanji, not so much.
It's a board game.
Right. But in the new ones, they're video games.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's about video games. It's not a video game adaptation.
I guess. Yeah.
It's not a video game adaptation.
I hear what you're saying.
I care very little about that.
I mean, like that.
It should be an adaptation of
that's kind of my that's where I was game. Headed was like yeah the adaptation because they're kind of notoriously bad, but there's been some great ones.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Well, yeah, based on
if we're going to include board games, then Clue would be such a major contender.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, just video games.
This is not hashtag board game blend. This is hashtag video game
exactly
movie blend. So
very rolls right off the tongue.
Getting a death stare from Jake for some reason. Our next premium episode.
No, because honestly, I really wasn't meaning to. I'm seriously like thinking about my pick, going like, can I pick that? I don't know if I'm allowed to pick that. I'll ask Gabe.
What is our next premium episode? We don't know what it's going to be.
Not yet. We're still finalizing our cast, so I don't have it nailed down until I know who all is going to be there.
Oh, fair enough. True, because our schedules are very, very busy.
Yeah, it's a crazy week.
Check the description below for more information on how to sign up for the Real Blend Premium. In the meantime, follow us on social media @Jake's Takes. at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean underscore O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. And the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you all next week with a brand new episode dropping on Friday. Thank you so much for listening. And Ubi.
Barbie.
I'm going to say Killers of the Flower Moon.
Because why not? Hey, somebody's got to.
That's a mouthful.